bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast. NFL week 14. It does feel a little bit unusual not having a college football podcast already in the can, but a busy slate of NFL action, plenty of ground to cover on today's show. I am your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider. And Payne, I got a lot of mentions on social media, people pretty distraught that we weren't going to provide a full hour breakdown of the annual Army-Navy showdown on our normal Wednesday slot.
Ooh, so sad. We're going to try to make our way to this game next year, and maybe if we do that, we'll have a breakdown of Army-Navy. I know you discussed potentially doing some of the smaller bowls with Brad, and then we'll obviously return for some of the biggest games. The sad part here is college football's been the moneymaker. The NFL's been the money burner, and so we got to pick that shit up a little bit in that regard. But without all of the college football breakdowns, we did enhance the NFL coverage a little bit. Seven games this week.
A monumental undertaking with seven games on the slate. Rather than share pleasantries, talk about TV shows, plans for the weekend, let's get right into some of the games. And it all kicks off in earnest on Thursday night in the old battle for Los Angeles. And we've seen this number on the move. The Las Vegas Raiders make the trip to SoFi Stadium to take on the Rams. You're looking at the Raiders, a full touchdown favorite. There are some soft sevens out there. Total in the game, 43.5. A couple of 43s if you shop around there. First meeting between these two franchises in Southern California since November 13th, 1994. I think that would have had you about 2 years old, Payne, back then. Going to feel like a Raiders home game if you believe some of the metrics being circulated by Vivid Seats and a lot of the other third-party ticket marketplaces, about a 65-35 split. If you're inclined to look at playoff scenarios because you ingest your NFL football each week through silver and black lenses, the Raiders are two games back of the seventh seed in the AFC, listed at right around 7-1 to make the postseason. We're 2-7, and only three teams have ever made the playoffs after being five games below 500 any point during the season: the 1970 Bengals, the 2014 Panthers, and 2020 Washington Commanders. The Rams, if eliminated, it would match the earliest playoff exit for a defending Super Bowl champion with 4 weeks left in the season since the Denver Broncos in 1999. When you look at the Rams, they've done nothing but burn money at the window. 3-8-1 ATS, the worst in the NFL this season, the worst 12-game ATS start by the defending Super Bowl champion since the 97 Packers, but this will mark only the second time Derek Carr has been a road favorite of 5+ points in his illustrious career. And Payne, right now, this Raiders offense is humming. It's Josh Jacobs, Davante Adams, representing more than 60% of their overall offensive production. The defense was no slouch last week, though, as they lived in the backfield and hit Justin Herbert 14 times. But the biggest question when you're trying to assess this game may be the Rams defense against this Raiders offense, or is it on the other side while we wait Sean McVay to tell us who's going to be starting under center against this tenacious Raiders front?
Yeah, I think what's really interesting about this is, you know, for casual bettors, it's easy to see all the Rams injuries and how they've played, dropping six straight and Vegas winning three straight, and you kind of gravitate towards the Raiders here. And I'll be honest, I just don't get close to this number. Only the Houston Texans with Kyle Allen under center are power rated worse than this iteration of the Rams, and I still don't get here. And obviously Kyle Allen no longer under center, but my number basically gets to me to like 4.2. So I'm not quite sure what to do here, because certainly there's been some sharp money on the Raiders. I just think the most glaring difference in this game, and you kind of hinted at it a little bit, but before I get to that specific matchup, I look at the difference in opponents played. I mean, the Raiders have faced the very easiest schedule in the NFL through 13 weeks. The Rams, a top 10 schedule. And I think the hope is that, you know, being on national TV, prime time, remove some of the quit element that a 3-9 team could have that no longer has aspirations of repeating as Super Bowl champions. And I don't really want to get into all that because you'll get the theory that guys always play 100% because they fear injury, right? That's the discussion. The eye in the sky don't lie, man. And if you want to throw on the tape and just watch Jalen Ramsey, oof. So
you're not thrilled with Jalen Ramsey's current cover grade or that he's given up more touchdowns than anybody else?
It's not that. I mean, just watch the effort in attempting to tackle last week. I mean, there is, he'd rather be anywhere else than attempting to make a tackle.
Payne, if you're a former Florida State defensive back who doesn't make any effort to tackle, it could get you the head coaching job at Colorado. So you have to think about a potential career trajectory for where Jalen Ramsey may want to go once he retires in the National Football League.
So the hope is obviously, right, like you get good Jalen Ramsey to hold Adams below expectation. There's not a ton else on the Raiders offense that keeps you up at night. And really that's the area where the Rams have struggled. 21st in EPA allowed to wide receiver one. So Ramsey has to show up. Certainly Josh Jacobs is on fire right now. He's the other guy you have to worry about. But if you've monitored that situation closely, right? Like Jacobs has been dealing with a calf and quad issue for multiple weeks now that have had him limited or missing some practice for, again, like almost a month, and now he's got 72 hours to recover here, and that's actually been the one element of the Rams defense that's been good. It's against the run, fifth in schedule adjusted run defense, and since week 7, where the Rams haven't won a game and there might be signs of quit, Rams are 6th in EPA per rush allowed over that stretch. Only 35% of runs have graded positive. That's 5th best, and you've also seen the Rams show an ability to really hunker down when opponents reach their red zone, just a 13% touchdown rate, 2nd best in the league. So there are some elements here where if Jalen Ramsey shows up, and you're not going to stop Devontae Adams, never, right? But if you can limit him below expectation, if you can stop the ground game, if you can continue to hunker down in the red zone, it kind of becomes difficult to cover a number that we're now out to at 7 some places. So I think that's interesting. The other thing you mentioned at the top was what Sean McVay said, in that we're going to run John Wolford out there, who's got a little bit of a neck injury. He's practiced in a limited fashion the last 2 days. We're going to have him go through warmups. If he can go, awesome. If not, then maybe it's Baker Mayfield. For me, it would be really smart for Sean McVay to at least start Bryce Perkins, right? Perkins isn't good by any measure, but he's so different from John Wolford that it could be tough to prepare for that on the short week if you're a Raiders defense and you don't know it's coming, because all the sentiment has been, hey, let's see if John Wolford's healthy enough. Hey, maybe it's Baker Mayfield, who we signed 48 hours ago and doesn't really know the offense. Those aren't as intriguing to me as a mobile quarterback that could present some issues that you might not know is coming on a short week.
It's definitely interesting when you think about the game of cat and mouse that inevitably takes place for defenses and how they've decided to try and go about game planning on a very short week. You mentioned Josh Jacobs, and I think it's a tremendous point. I know a lot of people clamoring for, oh, you have to bet his rushing yards over. You have to make a case for receiving yards. Let's see what his productivity looks like with 72 hours. He didn't practice really at all last week. It was questionable against the Chargers. Obviously went out there, performed, and we know how important he is to the Raiders and everything they're trying to do. At the same time, I think when you just look at the number here, and you talked about where your numbers take you, the Raiders played the Seahawks a few short weeks ago. The Raiders couldn't attract any money in the betting market. It was 3.5 pretty much is where it closed. You're now looking at a number here where the Raiders are laying a full touchdown. It will feel like a home game, but the number is still higher in this spot than where the Seahawks and Rams closed last week in that 6-6.5 range. So if you're a value seeker out there, you know, quit is great from a narrative perspective, but we really haven't seen that from the Rams and how much different this number could potentially be if the Rams hadn't given up that late touchdown to Geno Smith, weren't on that mired in that long losing streak, and what odds makers would have to do to adjust. So no doubt we're going to want to pay attention to the quarterback situation. You brought up Baker, and this will be the last thing on this game because I know we have a ton of games to get to. If Baker starts here, I mean, does the betting market respond favorably for a guy who hasn't been in the offense at all? And if you're going off of Bobby Wagner's comments earlier this week, didn't sound overly optimistic that Baker was going to be the panacea to make this offense hum on all cylinders.
It's a good question. So I would say personally, I'd rather have John Wolford under center. The idea that's like, oh, great, we we got Baker Mayfield our offensive playbook before we hit the plane. Right? Okay, it's 48 hours. He's not on the same page with any of his receivers. And so learning a brand new offense, getting in unison with some of your receiver group, I don't think that can be done in 48 hours. So I think the market would actually treat him as an upgrade. And my mindset's the actual inverse. I'd much rather have the Rams plus 7 with Wolford than I would say plus 5.5 with Baker Mayfield.
It makes a ton of sense. Continuity and understanding the playbook can be significantly more valuable than if these two quarterbacks are operating from a level playing field. We'll see exactly how that storyline continues to take shape leading up to Thursday Night Football's kickoff. On to Sunday we go, Payne, in a game that has been widely talked about given the line movement and obviously what these teams' records are coming into the game. That, of course, being the Vikings on the road against the Detroit Lions. Minnesota beat the Lions earlier this year but had to erase multiple double-digit deficits. The Lions, a consensus 2-point home favorite in this spot. Total in the game, 52.5. We addressed this on Monday's show, talking about how the look-ahead line was significantly different, how the market had adjusted. The Vikings in a little bit of a unique spot historically. They become the first team since the 1970 merger to be 8-plus games above 500, not resting their starters, and an underdog against the team with a losing record. A couple of factors in play there. I think the market in 2022, significantly more sophisticated than what it would have been, say, 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. When you're looking at the Vikings, they also have the longest win streak in the NFL in one score game since the 1970 merger. Their plus 10 point differential is the worst by a 10-team win through 12 games in NFL history. The Vikings extremely fortunate last week, beating the Jets 27-22, outgained by 199 yards of offense, and they were good in terms of keeping the Jets to field goals, not allowing them to score touchdowns. Kirk Cousins was worst in the NFL during week 13 at just 4.9 yards per attempt. He has had some good success against the Lions, but Payne, I think this is more about the Lions and their current form than it is about the Vikings, a team that's trending up offensively but quietly starting to look like an NFL franchise on the defensive side of the ball in recent weeks.
That's very true. And to your point about discussing this a little bit on Monday, the Lions were consensus plus 1 at that time. Now a 2-point favorite and really a 5-point move from the look ahead. And it's not overly shocking, right? I mean, the way Detroit's trending, to your point right now, we'd actually make them pick minus 20 on a neutral over Minnesota, despite the records being wildly different. And I know a lot of people are going to hear this game discussed. We're seeing national media members that are at least dipping their toes into the water, sending out tweets, how can Detroit be the favorite here? And when I look at this past, like, there is this familiar environment for Minnesota, right? This is a division game. They've been here before. It's, you know, the 1 o'clock start time, so it's not going to be unique to Kirk Cousins. You know, he's used to playing in a dome, all of those things, but you still have to give Detroit some home field advantage here, especially when you look at the Lions road home splits. It's one of the largest offensive dichotomies in the entire league. So 2 feels like the right number. Past the point though of the sticker price shock, like there are some underlying metrics here that are just wild that fully support the current price and would maybe even indicate this number is a touch short. I mean, I'm looking at this since week 9, Detroit's defense, to your point, 15th in EPA per play allowed. First 8 weeks, Detroit was dead last. If you look over the last 5 games and you adjust for opponent, Detroit's 3rd in defensive pass efficiency. Offensively, the first 7 weeks, Detroit's 22nd in EPA per play since week 8. Lions offense is 6th, and the unit's only getting healthier, right? Along the O-line, Swift and St. Brown appear near 100%. Jamison Williams got his feet wet last week, should see a slightly expanded role here against Minnesota. And then on the other side, it's the complete inverse, right? Over the first 7 weeks, Minnesota and Kevin O'Connell's offense was 13th in EPA per play. Since week 8, it's 23rd. Defensively, Minnesota's been hit with some injuries in their secondary. First 7 weeks, the Vikings were 14th in EPA per play, per pass allowed. Since week 8, it's dipped a little bit, 18th. So an incremental decline there. It does sound like Cam Dantzler is trending in the right direction for the Vikings, so that'll be a nice addition back to their secondary. But it just paints the picture that both sides of the ball are enhancing for Detroit, both sides of the ball for Minnesota declining. And there's an interesting matchup within this game as well, one that we mentioned, I think, on our Thursday breakdown during Thanksgiving week, but we've also mentioned it from time to time when talking about the Vikings, and it's Kirk Cousins splits versus man and zone coverage. The Lions play a top five rate of man coverage. Cousins is bottom eight among qualifying quarterbacks in both completion rate and adjusted net yards per pass attempt against man coverage. EPA numbers dip significantly as well. The Lions also typically like to blitz in front of their man coverage. Detroit's the sixth most blitz-happy team. Out of 38 qualifying quarterbacks through 13 weeks, Kirk Cousins is quarterback 34 against the blitz. So something to think about here. And like, you know, listen, like, Cousins has played the Commanders, Buffalo, Dallas, Belichick, and the Jets the last five games. They're all top 10 defenses. Even with the Lions' defensive improvements, undoubtedly, like, Cousins is stepping down in class a little bit here. The total is 53, so it's not like Cousins and the Vikings are getting shut out. But if the high rates of man coverage and blitzing impact Cousins like they have all season, right, maybe the Lions get that extra stop. Maybe Cousins turns it over and creates an added possession for Detroit's offense. Maybe Justin Jefferson, you know, beats Okuda and he's wide open, but pressure gets to Cousins and he airmails one or skips a ball. You're just trying to find any edge you can within the game when entering a market, right? And on the opposite end of the spectrum, like, the Vikings defense lives in zone. It's all they play. Goff has been torching zone coverage all season, and he's trending right now as number one quarterback in EPA per dropback against zone coverage the last back half of the season. So you're looking at two teams just trending drastically different in some of the underlying metrics, and the matchups within this game on both sides are favoring Detroit as well. So it's not stunning at all that they're a two-point favorite here, despite what the public and, you know, your national coverage and media members will have you.
Are we ever going to go through a week during the course of his career that DeAndre Swift can avoid the injury report? I mean, good Lord, this dude finally...
Shoulder knee, that's all it is.
He finally starts to look healthy last week. 14 carries versus the Jags was the most since the season opener versus the Eagles. 49 receiving yards was a season high, and Lions fans are flying high. There's reason for optimism, and then Wednesday, Swift shows up on the injury report. I obviously do expect him to play. Jamal Williams experienced a career renaissance of sorts, 14 rushing touchdowns, more than he's had in his entire NFL career coming into this year. The best part about that, 8 of those 14 touchdowns have been from exactly 1 yard out, and
yeah, the fantasy vulture.
Oh, that's what you want. You need touchdowns in a touchdown only league to try and be able to take advantage. And then you mentioned Jamison Williams, but Amon-Ra St. Brown clearly putting up gaudy numbers there, developing that huge rapport with Jared Goff that should be able to pay dividends. And you mentioned this Vikings team. I mean, talk about a team living a charmed existence. You wonder where one of these games things will get away from. We joked, obviously, a couple weeks ago when we used the Cowboys as a best bet, that all the regression for the Vikings' entire season might have been consolidated into four quarters. Well, there's more regression coming at some point. We'll see if it comes as early as Sunday for their trip to the Motor City.
And you go back to that first meeting, too, right? Like, we watched that game intently because we had some money on the total in that game, but the Detroit Lions built two double-digit leads on the road against the Vikings, who were healthier then, and Detroit was not healthier then. So, I mean, it just seems like a team that they've played tough even when they've been worst versions of themselves, you know?
It's pretty wild. I mean, you try and figure out teams and you want to catch them before the market adjusts accordingly on the uptick, and the same thing on the downswing. The Vikings have been extremely fortunate. You've seen them take money against, which feels like the third straight week. Obviously, each of the last 2 weeks, the Vikings were able to get there against the New England Patriots and against the New York Jets. Maybe this is the week that the market catches up to them. Speaking of those Jets, they'll go across the state to Western New York to take on the Buffalo Bills. Buffalo out to a double-digit favorite in Orchard Park, laying 10, total 43.5. The Jets can become the first team since 2006, Payne, to defeat an opponent twice as an underdog of 8-plus points in a single season. In the first meeting, when the Jets upset the Bills 20-17, they did trail 14-3. Josh Allen had arguably his worst day of the season, had a passer rating under 50, was sacked 5 times. Ended up being the only game without a passing touchdowns for him this year. Zach Wilson, of course, was the Jets starter then, changing dynamic there. Sauce Gardner did a tremendous job limiting the effectiveness of Gabe Davis and Stephon Diggs. Gave up one reception on 15 coverage snaps against that tandem. Matt Milano and Jordan Poyer did not play. Von Miller, however, was out there. Unfortunately for Bills fans, the optimism about Miller potentially having an impact when they get into the postseason no longer going to be the case, as he underwent surgery on his ACL. The Jets, meanwhile, dealing with a flu bug this week in practice. He had a couple of key contributors miss on Wednesday. We'll monitor the injury reports on Thursday and Friday to see who may be back out there. Payne, the Jets move the ball effectively, but if you're not going to score touchdowns against good teams, you're not going to win a lot of football games. There is no doubt the Bills, having extra time to prepare, will have a few wrinkles in store to get revenge against the team in the division where they widely said it was one of the worst games they played as a collective. When you look at the Bills' defense, good against the pass, only going to get better as Tre'Davious White continues to see his workload tick up. Have to imagine Mike White could have his hands full if the Jets aren't able to turn Zonovan Knight loose and allow Bam to go bonkers.
Yeah, I think you're probably spot on there. And past the flu bug that was moving through the Jets locker room, another moving part here is could be some cold and rain in the forecast. So something to think about there as well. But ultimately for the Jets offense, it comes down to like, what are we getting from Mike White? The staff obviously trusts him. And you can see that in the numbers because the Jets have been far more aggressive throwing it with him under center, about a 7% increase in pass rate over expectation from a neutral game script versus what they were allowing Zach Wilson to throw the ball. And the one thing when you look at Buffalo's defense, how you attack it is you have to be decisive. You have to get rid of it quick. We know Buffalo lives in zone. But for me, this is just a monster step up in class. I mean, Mike White's played the Chicago Bears, who are dead last in defensive pass efficiency. The Minnesota Vikings, 28th in defensive pass efficiency when I make tweaks for their game against Miami without Tua. And Minnesota is also missing Cam Dantzler in the secondary. And now all of a sudden, Mike White gets number 7 Buffalo, who's likely better than that because they've had some injuries in the secondary. And all of a sudden, they're getting healthier, right? I mean, you got Poyer and Tre'Davious White back. And this isn't just like a Fugazi ranking. Buffalo's played a top 5 schedule of offenses. And I think where you start to look at, you know, where Mike White's had some of his success, most of the damage is through the air using play action, something we highlighted last week that he'd have success against Minnesota using, and he did. It's just this massive dichotomy. When Mike White throws with play action, his passer rating's 53 points higher, adjusted accuracy increases, big time throw rate soars. But you can't really play action the Bills defense overly well with how they're built and schemed. I think we broke that down and mentioned it on a Monday night game when they're playing the Tennessee Titans, who are also very much reliant on throwing with play action. And when you look last season, there is a data point here. Mike White faced the Bills. It went so poorly, we never saw Mike White again last season. And he didn't complete a single play-action pass attempt against Buffalo last year. Had 3 turnover-worthy plays on 5 play-action attempts. 4 interceptions on the day for Mike White against this Buffalo defense. It almost feels like the approach has to be Mike White in shotgun, let him see the field, ditch play action in this specific matchup, have White be quick and decisive, find the holes in the Bills zone, take those 4, 5, 6 yard passes, and just kind of keep it moving. But there really isn't a path here for a ton of offensive success, as you highlighted at the top, Todd, because I don't think the Jets are going to be able to run it. And if you look since week 8, when Breece Hall wasn't in the backfield, the Jets are 25th in rushing success rate. And so if you can't run, and Mike White can't rely on throwing with play action, there's some weather in the forecast, right? Could be bleak offensively here for the Jets.
The Jets' defense has obviously done the lion's share of the heavy lifting for everything that this team has been able to accomplish this year. They're allowing 11.1 fewer points per game than last season. It's the largest year-to-year improvement since the 2000-2001 Los Angeles Rams. 10th highest pressure rate, Payne, despite the 3rd lowest blitz rate this season. 27 sacks without blitzing this season has them tied for 3rd most in the NFL. When you look at PFF and how they grade out this this defense. They've given the Jets the best overall grade. The big three clearly living up to advanced billing. Quinnen Williams, C.J. Mosley, and rookie Sauce Gardner exceeding expectations there. But they're going to have their hands full against a Bills offense that's trying to figure things out as they go. I know Josh Allen wasn't overly explosive in the Thursday night win against the Buffalo Bills, but to the Bills' credit, they're getting to be more diverse, not just with the passing game, but also running the football. You also saw them unleash James Cook with a more increased workload and even roll out formations where James Cook and Nyheim Hines were out there on the field at the same time. You almost believe, if you watch this Bills team, that they're trying to figure it all out, knowing, hey, look, we were going to get into the playoffs. We figured we could win the division, but we wanted to play some of our cards tight to the vest before we got into the most meaningful portion of our schedule, December, January, and hopefully a date in February in Glendale to play for the Lombardi Trophy.
Yeah, I think your main point there in Buffalo having some extra time to throw a couple wrinkles and counterpunch what the Jets did to them defensively makes a world of sense. You go back to that first meeting, I mean, the Jets just completely shut down Josh Allen and the Bills offense, and that was when they were healthier than they are now. I mean, just season lows across the board in both counting stats and efficiency metrics. And I'm just going to be interested to see how Robert Saleh and obviously Jeff Ulbrich follow up that game plan this go around, because there were a ton of things they did that just completely caught Josh Allen and even Ken Dorsey, to your point, by surprise. The Jets morphed into something they weren't and did things they hadn't put on film prior to that game. And you look at the first thing was the Jets didn't blitz at all. Now, they're typically not a high blitz rate team. Saleh thinks he's got the horses up front to get natural pressure. But everyone had been blitzing Josh Allen because the splits were a little bit better if you sent heat. But the Jets only blitzed two times all game. So the four-man rush worked extremely well. And when the Jets sent fewer than five pass rushers, Allen was 18 for 33 with two picks, a negative 0.35 EPA per dropback, and a 48 passer rating in that first matchup. So we'll see. Right, Buffalo probably knows that could be coming. This is going to be the ultimate cat and mouse game here. The other thing Robert Saleh did to kind of throw a wrench into Buffalo's plans offensively, and we mentioned it last week and in passing and didn't realize we were going to be talking about this game this week, but the first thing was in the opening matchup, Sauce Gardner traveled. So leading up to the first Bills game, like Sauce played 96% of snaps on the left side. Reed played 96% of his snaps on the right. Against Buffalo, it was the inverse. Sauce played 56% of snaps on the right, Reed 56% on the left. So it kind of threw a wrinkle into where they were doing some things formationally with Stephon Diggs, and it kind of created this idea that Sauce was traveling with Diggs somewhat. And then there was this interesting usage of defensive linemen where on late passing downs, Saleh would take a defensive end. Most of the time, it was Jermaine Johnson. And you'd have him stand up in the middle of the line of scrimmage about 2 yards off the ball and rush him that way. And that caused some real problems on those 15 snaps. So this side of the ball is just very much scheme-driven. If Saleh can dial up something unique again, what's the encore performance, right, for that? Like, the Bills, you know, probably going to, at least with this extra time, be prepared for what transpired in the first matchup. So this is really interesting to me. Obviously, if you look at the Bills, they've struggled in second halves in most weeks. That's a little bit concerning. I don't know if it's a Ken Dorsey thing. I don't know if it's an injury thing with Josh Allen, but, you know, they've struggled in the back half. And so I think where this just is difficult for me to assess is, what is Robert Saleh come up with here? Can you throw the last curveball again and have just as much success with it? Or do you just have to come up with something completely different, knowing the Bills with extra time have probably ironed some things out to combat what unfolded in the first matchup? But ultimately, this is really interesting because I envisioned some Jets money coming into the market, driving this down. And we were kind of, I think both, Todd, waiting on some advantage teasers. And I don't think we're going to get there with a six. And this morning, we're starting to see a couple shops even trend back up towards the 10.
Yeah, I was not thrilled. Figured that we could get a move from 9.5 to 8.5 and stay in no man's land to help out that teaser window. Alas, we see one shop go to 10, and you see another number of shops follow suit to take it. Pretty much 10, I won't quite say is the consensus right now, but there's many shops that I respect showing 10s as showing 9.5. So we'll see ultimately where this price tag settles, what the Jets practice report looks like for the next couple of days, and how they go about trying to sweep the season series against the Buffalo Bills. A game pain in the division that loses a little bit of intrigue because there's some star power and luster lost between the Baltimore Ravens and the Pittsburgh Steelers. The Steelers, 2.5-point home favorites. Total in the game, 36.5. It is down a touch from where it would have been if we recorded real early on Thursday morning from 37. When you look at the Steelers, they've now won 4 straight games versus the Ravens by a grand total of 13 points. That's one shy of tying the longest streak by either team in this particular rivalry. When I look at this particular game, Payne, so much made of Lamar Jackson. We know about the contract dispute and the Ravens trying to figure out exactly what kind of money they want to give him to make him the face of the franchise. We've talked a little bit about the off-field antics and some of the shenanigans that have gone on. When you're the Baltimore Ravens front office, if Tyler Huntley can go out there and win football games and deliver at a high level over the next couple of weeks, it obviously hurts Lamar Jackson's leverage a little bit. I'm not saying it's a one-for-one replacement, but I do think in a game like this against a young quarterback in Kenny Pickett who's trending in the right direction, we've seen him perform admirably back-to-back weeks against inferior defenses in the Indianapolis Colts and, of course, the Atlanta Falcons, both coming in road situations. This is step up in class against your historical rival. Is it about how Huntley will perform leading this Ravens offense against the Steelers defense that's trending up, or if the Ravens defense can do what it's going to be asked of it against the Pittsburgh Steelers group that'll probably be largely one-dimensional, knowing they shouldn't have any success running the football here?
All good questions. I mean, ultimately, to me, this is about price more than anything, knowing the last two matchups were decided by a total of 4 points, including one of which was an overtime game. But you start to see what Lamar's value is here, right? I mean, the Ravens were -5 on the look ahead last week, a couple places. Once the market did reach Pittsburgh -3 Tuesday, we did see an appetite, right, for Baltimore at that key of 3. And that's ultimately the question, right? Is Lamar Jackson worth 8 numerical points and more in value when you're going through the 4 or the 3 and touching the other 3? I think we're going to find out here, but ultimately,
especially with a total this low.
Yeah, well, apparently, right, the Black and Blue Division trademark was up, so the AFC North decided to give us this matchup with a 36.5-point total to enhance descriptiveness. But listen, Tyler Huntley is a really poor man's version of Lamar, and he allows Baltimore to not change its entire offensive identity. But I think there's real question marks about Greg Roman's creativity, and past Mark Andrews, there's extreme questions about Baltimore's offensive talent. And, you know, specific to this game, you have to keep an eye on left tackle Patrick McCarry. He's not been on the injury report, played 39 snaps last week against the Broncos, left with a toe injury, and again, just has not practiced yet this week. So that'll be interesting to monitor. But what we've seen in past spots like this is Baltimore really just turns to its identity and wants to be more physical and beat you at the line of scrimmage and get that ground game going and just kind of lean on you. And that might be where Baltimore finds some success this week, is on the ground, because Pittsburgh hasn't been the most stingy run defense. TJ Watt is certainly out there. He is helping the defense, but by no means is he 100%. And you can kind of tell that just watching him play and seeing some of his effectiveness in the metrics. But Pittsburgh is 19th in EPA per rush allowed the last 3 weeks against Cincinnati, Indy, and Atlanta. So I think you'll see Baltimore be able to get their ground game going a little bit. Specific to Tyler Huntley, I think he's kind of proven to be what he's going to be, and that's a short to intermediate passer that's willing to use his legs a little bit. Last week, averaged 5.8 air yards, third lowest mark of the week, but he completed 27 of 32 balls. And you go back to last season, really the same thing. Now, the advantage is, I would think, that he's at least gotten a glimpse of Pittsburgh's defense. He at least knows this rivalry. He's been in that moment because he did draw a start against the Steelers last season. The area of relative weakness for Pittsburgh is that they're bottom 5 in yards per pass attempt allowed, yards per completion, and touchdown rate. So it's not this like vaunted pass defense. So Tyler Huntley might have some success just getting the ball out on time, being accurate and delivering it. I think within the confines of the offense, he'll find some success there. The interesting part on the other side of the ball, though, and we've mentioned this, I think, for a few weeks now, is Pittsburgh's been substantially better out of their bye. And the run rate over expectation has increased dramatically, and that's because they've had some success on the ground. They're fifth in EPA per rush since week 10, over 50% of runs have graded successful. But the last four games are against run defenses that have an average rank of 20th in schedule-adjusted run defense. So now you get Baltimore, who's number six, and since they've gotten healthier along the D-line and added some parts to their front seven, Ravens are number one in EPA per rush allowed since week 9, 25% of runs have graded successful over that stretch. So the Steelers, if you've watched, have taken the ball out of Kenny Pickett's hands a little bit more out of the bye. And I think Baltimore almost forces this to be more of a Kenny Pickett game than Pittsburgh may want. Okorafor, for the Steelers' right tackle, is also dealing with a shoulder injury. He left the Falcons game early, hasn't practiced yet this week. Keep an eye on that. Game might also be a little wet, so monitor that situation as well. I don't know if we're getting back to three. I'm not sure if that's a thing, but it was definitely quite sharp knowing the group that moved there. If it ever gets back to three, you know, you'll probably see another wave. If it doesn't, you know, you're looking at that classic Wong teaser through the 3 and 7, getting out to 8.5 with a really, really low variance game with this total at 36.5 now.
The other thing for the Steelers, too, when you watch them over the last couple of weeks, they've come out with dynamic offensive game plans going all the way back to their game against the Cincinnati Bengals. And what they're doing at halftime, I'm not quite sure constitutes anything close to an adjustment, because the offense has lacked creativity and punch each of the last few weeks, turning games that should be comfortable wins into much tighter affairs getting deep into the fourth quarter. We'll see which team can play chess and stay one step ahead. Obviously, Baltimore knows that their margin for error in the division, especially without their starting quarterback, continues to narrow given the current form that we've seen from the Cincinnati Bengals. And the Pittsburgh Steelers, sitting at 5-7, not going to make the playoffs, but obviously want us to try and build some momentum behind a rookie quarterback that they can take into next season. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there as well. Most importantly, follow all things Bet the Board at Bet the Board Pod on Twitter. And if you haven't already done so, encourage folks to check out our Cardboard Chat podcast. Episode 7 dropped earlier this week. Payne does an outstanding job in the host chair, nonetheless, talking to Jesse Craig of PWCC Marketplace about some of the best investment strategies, some of the bigger pieces that they see moving through their shop, and ways for interested sports investors to try and diversify their portfolio and get involved in the trading card space. Eagles and Giants, Payne. It feels like we're going through every game on the board in chronological order here. The Eagles, right around a touchdown favorite as they'll travel to MetLife Stadium to take on their division rivals. Total in the game, 45. When you look at the Eagles, the seventh team since 2000 to be favored by 3+ points in each of their first 13 games of the season. The Eagles, 5-0 straight up on the road this year, but just 1-4 against the number. Meanwhile, offensively, they became the first team since the 1987 Raiders with 350 passing yards the week after rushing for 350. So they've shown those chameleon-like tendencies and an ability to adapt to what the opposing defenses will show them. And it's really shown some progress and progression from Jalen Hurts. When you look at his deep ball and his pocket passer rating, they've been off the chart. The one area where Hurts has struggled this year has been against the blitz. Lo and behold, the counterpart he's going to face here in the New York Giants, they don't have a lot of defensive difference makers, especially right now in the secondary with Adoree Jackson and Xavier McKinney still dealing with injuries. But we know one thing about Wink. It may be Monday, it may be Tuesday, it may be Thursday, Friday. He wants to try and pin his ears back and come after opposing quarterbacks. Will Philadelphia be able to read, react, and allow Jalen Hurts to be in a position to have some success against this Giants defense?
So I think the one thing that is interesting to this game is hopefully the rain continues to subside a little bit and we get a clean game here. Yesterday, the projection was like nearly 0.8 inches of rain with an 85% chance as we record this Thursday morning, down to 0.28 inches of rain and a 30% chance at kickoff. So something to at least monitor from now until kickoff. And because of that, right, we've seen this total really ping pong back and forth. Under 45.5 gets smoked down to 44. 44 gets hit back to 45 and a half. We've now kind of settled at 45. Ultimately, you know, the next move is likely decided based upon the weather. Similar situation to the side. Open 6 got as high as 7.1. A group that uses some of our accounts cheaply bought to 7.5 on the Giants, causing this to trickle down to where we're kind of at now at, like, call it 6.8. To me, when I look at this game and assess some of the matchups, this is the largest net early down discrepancy of the week between two winning teams. If you look at early downs, the first three quarters, Eagles are number 2 in offensive EPA per play, number 1 in success rate. Defensively, the Eagles are 6th in early downs. Giants, 20th on offense, 30th in defensive EPA per play allowed on early downs the first three quarters. So it's just a massive dichotomy there. And you know, early downs is one of the most predictive measures we have. Obviously, turnovers is larger, but you can't quite predict that. I think when I look at the Giants defense, you're trying to find a way for them to get stops, and I'm not sure that's completely in the cards when you factor in some of the injuries. Adoree Jackson, their lead corner, still hasn't practiced. McKinney still hasn't practiced. Now Leonard Williams hasn't practiced after leaving last week early with a neck injury. So that's arguably, you know, 3 of the Giants' most 5 important defenders. Other thing you have to factor in, the Giants have faced 2 good running quarterbacks all season. In one of those instances against the Bears, they weren't in the mode of running Justin Fields virtually every snap. And then the other was Lamar Jackson in the opener, ran for 77 yards, and there was this uniqueness to Wink knowing him quite well. So I think this might be really the first time where, you know, they face a mobile quarterback that could give them a little bit of trouble. But to your point, Todd, the game plan is simple. Expect blitz from Wink and man coverage behind it. If you play man coverage, it's typically a recipe for a mobile quarterback having some success on the ground. And I don't know, you know, sometimes data can be a little bit different from place to place. But against the blitz, Jalen Hurts has done a really good job taking care of the ball. Just 2 turnover-worthy plays all season against the blitz. His passer rating is 100 when the heat's on. The Eagles have shown to be a team that also gets out to leads here. Most yards per play in the first half, most points per game in the first half. And from a game script perspective, it's not really conducive to success for the Giants to have to play catch up with the weapons they have. I'm just really interested to see where this price goes, but another battle this time of year on both the side and totaled, and just a really, really wonky season across the board.
Yeah, I mean, this is a Giants team as well that if they struggle in man coverage against Philadelphia's wide receivers, I'm not sure they're going to be able to take solace in what their run defense has done in recent weeks, allowing more than 5 yards per carry so far this season. Has them 30th in the league. You look at where they are from just a counting stats standpoint outside the top 25. Washington, Dallas, and Detroit over the last 3 weeks have all had tremendous amounts of success running between the tackles and forcing the Giants to really wilt under some of that weight of opposing ground games. So, big game within the division. We know that the Giants, obviously not trending the right way. They were playing well above their weight class early in the year, but water appears to be reaching its level, and we'll see if Philadelphia can make it 12 wins in 13 games this Sunday against the Giants. Normally, we stick in rotation order, but because the schedule is flexed, we're going to stay in chronological order to at least stay on brand here. And what I think becomes one of the more fascinating games of the entire weekend, again, in the Bay Area involving the 49ers. This one for a very different reason than why we were excited to watch the game last week against the Miami Dolphins. The 49ers, 3.5-point home favorites. It is trending towards 3 at a lot of higher profile shops. Total 37.5 as they'll welcome in the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Tom Brady versus Brock Purdy features the largest gaps in starting quarterback matchups in all-time wins, passing touchdowns, passing yards, and age. Payne, I think the first question I have to ask, even before you get into the matchups on both sides of the ball here, the betting market has really struggled in terms of trying to attribute a proper value to Jimmy Garoppolo and what he has actually meant to the 49ers. You look at Brock Purdy, his inexperience, clearly 3.5 points. Maybe it's fair. Maybe it's not. We know what Kyle Shanahan's record has been as head coach of the 49ers when he has Jimmy Garoppolo under center. Significantly better at 38-17 than when he's got any other quarterback at 9-29. I know Brock Purdy has said the right things. You read the comments from former 49ers like Joe Montana, some of the players in the defense, Trent Williams, about his leadership traits. But it's such an interesting study because Brock Purdy was a guy that was getting a first-round grade before he really struggled over his final two seasons in Iowa State, becomes Mr. Irrelevant, comes out there, does what's asked him against the Dolphins. But the nice part about the 49ers, you don't need a quarterback to go out there and win games. They just can't lose them with a defense this good. But how different do we think the offense could potentially look with Brock Purdy taking over for now injured Jimmy Garoppolo?
So let me ask you the question, and I'll peel back the curtain. It's not into an attacking manner, right? Because I know learn how to speak. You and I discussed this game a little bit Sunday evening, and your sentiment was a little bit more 49ers, and now it sounds like just the vibe I'm hearing, not as much in love with that side and might actually lean the other way.
I don't lean the other way, but the dynamic has definitely changed. I mean, I think it's so interesting when you look at how a game like this shapes up, because there's unknown commodities, and we talk about sports bettors typically having better models or better intuitive sense of what the unknown can mean. But clearly you're seeing a battle, and I've talked to bettors that I respect that are on both sides of the fence in this game. One group running to take four when the market opened there, given Tampa's struggles against the Saints, and another that's probably going to look to lay three if this number continues to trend down. So even amongst sophisticated bettors here, it's a real problem. But for me, I look at this 49ers team, and I'm not going to say it's paint by numbers with the quarterback, but I think the 49ers defense against the Tampa offense is a bigger disparity than what you're going to see from the Tampa defense, one that's trending up against the run against the 49ers offense led by an inexperienced quarterback.
So we're seeing and hearing the same things, right? Because I've seen Tampa plus four come in, and I've been hearing that at three, San Francisco could be interesting. And I can see both sides of the coin, right? If you like the 49ers minus three, the thought process is massive coaching advantage for Shanahan, DeMeco Ryans, extra day of rest. Buccaneers played a high leverage game on Monday night. Now they travel across the country on a short week. Like, what's the line if over the last four games, the Buccaneers don't just miraculously win two of them against the Rams and Saints on the final possession? And then I think additionally, the thought is Brock Purdy is a guy Kyle Shanahan handpicked to run his system. He's accurate. Last week, called off the bench in a game plan designed for another quarterback, Purdy had an 81% adjusted accuracy rate when he was kept clean. And we know Purdy has a quick release. Purdy's more mobile than Jimmy G. And now he's going to have a game plan that's new, that's specific for him, that likely has some wrinkles that haven't been put on film yet. And then you think about the other side of the ball, right? Tom Brady and the Buccaneers offense have played the ninth easiest schedule of defenses. Now you get number two, San Francisco. Well, you can't run on San Francisco, right? They're elite there, and now you have the return of Arik Armstead up the middle, and he got his feet wet last week, would expect more snaps from him this week. And all Byron Leftwich has done at the order of Todd Bowles is run on early downs. And if you look on the season, early down runs the first three quarters, it's led Tampa to a 32% rushing success rate, good for 28th in the league. So you would think, like, Tom Brady is going to be faced with a lot of second and long and third and long situations if the run game garbage persists. Tom Brady's been horrific in those situations. He's 21st out of 24 qualifying quarterbacks with at least 100 attempts on second and third down with at least 8 yards to go. Brady is also 24th in EPA per dropback on late downs, all distances to go. And you can't throw over the middle on the 49ers. Well, that's really where Chris Godwin lines up, right? 74% of his snaps are from the slot. That's really the only target that Tom Brady's been in lockstep with recently. You have to throw to the perimeter to beat the 49ers defense. Mike McDaniel told you that last week with his game plan, a guy that knows the 49ers defense better than anyone. And you look at Brady and Evans, they just have not been on the same page for about a month now. Prior to Monday night against the Saints, Evans had only caught 18 of his prior 37 targets. So that's the thought process for those that like the 49ers kind of waiting for this to dip and lay the three. If you like Tampa plus four, the thought process is, right, Brock Purdy, dead last in air yards per attempt last week. There's film on him now. He declined each season at Iowa State. And that this is a massive downgrade from Jimmy G, because we have six seasons of data that suggests Jimmy G is better than everyone believes, right? I mean, he's got 57 games under his belt in a 49ers uniform. San Francisco is number two in EPA per play when Jimmy G's in the game. But the 49ers are 31st in EPA per play when Jimmy G isn't on the field over that stretch. The other factor here is the 49ers have played the second easiest schedule of defenses this season. And the two defenses that Kyle Shanahan and the 49ers have gone against that rank above average in schedule adjusted defensive efficiency, the Broncos and the Saints, scored 23 combined points in those games. And now you get the Buccaneers defense that's seventh in schedule adjusted efficiency. So a huge step up in class for the 49ers offense while breaking in a third string quarterback. But those are the two differing mindsets on this game and why we're having a battle. And typically, Todd, I've found over the years, you get a lot less bloody if you're on the sidelines and not partaking in said battles, especially, you know, when you're trying to outrun the vig here. So that's kind of where I land on this. And again, it just continues to show that this market has a lot more different players in it than it's ever had. There's a lot of movement that's happening now, and it's not the sophistication of camouflaging things. It's just the sophistication of more bettors into this market and not having access to all of it, to where you're seeing things move and not knowing who's responsible for it as much as in years past. But this is continues just to be a very wonky season that we're looking at here. And ultimately, this is another game where there's going to be a little bit of a battle.
Yeah, a variety of changing factors. Some interesting comments coming from Kyle Shanahan, I thought, in the wake of the Jimmy Garoppolo injury. He said the offense would have to change a lot less with Jimmy Garoppolo going to Brock Purdy and some of their core principles versus what they had to do earlier in the year when they had tailored an offense around Trey Lance's skill set. Before they thought Jimmy Garoppolo was going to be a part of the franchise going forward. So we'll see if Brock Purdy is able to unlearn some of the habits that had his skill set eroding over his last couple seasons in Ames. I saw enough Hunter Deckers this year that I'm not going to blame Brock Purdy entirely for everything that went awry under Matt Campbell's tutelage. We'll see if Kyle Shanahan can work some of his magic there. But no doubt, an interesting game to watch. The Bucs, of course, traveling across the country on a short week off that emotional win against the Saints, a game where they had to erase a late 13-point deficit to snap victory from the jaws of defeat. Sunday night football pain puts us in a familiar destination because it feels like this team plays all of its games in prime time, at least lately. That being the Los Angeles Chargers. And right now, this number has been on the move, and we've already gone through the key of three out to 3.5 with the Dolphins, a 3.5-point road favorite. Total in the game, 51.5. First time Miami has been flexed in a Sunday night football since the NFL instituted flex scheduling back in 2006. Kudos to Mike McDaniel and Tua for making this franchise relevant again. The second career meeting between two quarterbacks that'll be inextricably linked for the duration of their careers, the 5th and 6th overall pick in the 2020 draft. They did play in week 10 back in 2020. The Dolphins won that game 29-21. And when you look at this draft class in its totality, beyond just the two that'll be on full display between Tua and Justin Herbert on Sunday night, obviously tremendous years being put forth by Joe Burrow and Jalen Hurts. And I'll be honest, didn't see this coming from Jalen Hurts in any capacity. When you try and assess the Dolphins' offense, streak of four straight games scoring 30-plus points snapped. They do average 6.3 yards per play, second in the NFL. Tua turned it over three times in the loss to the 49ers. He had three total turnovers in the previous nine games. Finished with a completion percentage of 55%, or shade under, I should say, and a sub-80 rating. Miami, not quite 100% offensively. We want to monitor the injury reports to figure out what that offensive line will look like. Jalen Waddle should be out there, but was a shell of himself in the second half against the 49ers last week. But Payne, right now, this is a Chargers defense taking on water. Asante Samuel Jr. had no answers for Davante Adams. The Chargers weren't able to generate a pass rush against the Raiders. You'd have to think that there is an ample path for success if Miami is going to get back on the right side of the ledger and try and hang 30 points on their opponent with their second straight game on the West Coast.
So there's two matchups for me that will really dictate this game. I think the more glaring one I'll get to first here, and it's actually Justin Herbert's ability to attack the Dolphins' weak point. You have to be able to throw on Miami. And if you can give your quarterback enough time to do that, there's going to be plenty to be had against the Dolphins secondary. I mean, you just kind of look through things, whether it's injury-wise, whether it's metrically, right? Byron Jones is still out. Brandon Jones out with the ACL. Nick Needham out with the Achilles. Xavien Howard, who we've talked about, is being a little bit overrated because He's just a highlight reel ball hawk, but currently cornerback 84 out of 128 qualifiers in coverage grade. But to do what you need to do against Miami's vulnerability, you have to be able to protect. And that's something, to your point, that the Chargers weren't able to do last week. And I think when I was looking at some of the numbers, Herbert was pressured on 43% of his dropbacks against the Raiders. Now, you look at what the Dolphins are doing. Bradley Chubb, now that he's acclimated to the Dolphins scheme, last three games, Miami's pressure rate on opposing quarterbacks is just soaring, 42%. So the one thing that we're going to have to monitor here is the injury report for starting right tackle Trey Pipkins and starting center Corey Linsley, who both missed last week against the Raiders, but both are considered day-to-day. If those two miss, right, that means the Chargers are down both tackles, their center, not good. But I think there's some optimism that both are going to play. And the other part of Miami's pass defense that's a mess for what feels like a decade now is they can't defend tight ends or running backs. Gerald Effort is coming off his best game of the season last week. Miami's allowed the second most receptions per game to tight ends, fourth most touchdowns. Miami's also bottom 10 in the league defending running back passes. So that's where you can get Austin Eckler involved. So I think there's at least an offensive path where if you can get two guys healthy on your O-line and create some level of protection for Justin Herbert, there's going to be some opportunities down the field. There's going to be some opportunities for Everett and Eckler as well. The second matchup advantage is actually on the other side of the ball, and I think you're kind of hinting at Miami having some offensive success here. Mike McDaniel sounded optimistic that Teron Armstead would return, and he's been a guy that hasn't needed to practice to play. Now, Miami's very much a pass-first team. The Dolphins are seventh in pass rate over expectation, and you can certainly attack the Chargers through the air, but where that defense of Brandon Staley's been an absolute sieve is on the ground. And you start to look at some of the parts, and you mentioned Waddle a little bit, but Tua's playing, might not be 100%. Waddle's playing, but not 100%. And we know how the Chargers are built defensively. We know Mike McDaniel is a head coach that devises game plans specifically for opponent, and he's got this pedigree of run game coordinator. It wouldn't be shocking if the game state remains neutral or slanted in the Dolphins' favor that Miami relies on the ground game. I mean, the Chargers are 30th in schedule adjusted run defense. And if you go back since their week 8 bye, Chargers have allowed over 51% of runs to great successful, dead last in the NFL, 10% more than the league average over that stretch. And so this has the potential to be more of a Jeff Wilson, Raheem Mostert game than most typical Dolphins offensive performances. And I think that's partly why we've seen this total come off the 53, Todd, and it's as low as 51.5 now, because I do envision the Dolphins being a little bit more run heavy. And if you've gone back and looked at some of the Dolphins performances this season, when they are not being pushed offensively, they kind of take their foot off the gas a little bit. And so I think there's this clear correlation to side and total here, where if Miami's the side, they're running a little bit more. That's what the market is seeming to indicate. You could have laid minus 125 on the money line Sunday night. We're now out to 3.5.
Thanks for the reminder. I appreciate that.
And so that's why we're seeing the correlation to the under, because the belief is that Miami will be able to run the ball a little bit more here. Now, if you like the Chargers and they're able to score some points, that's going to push Miami a little bit more, and you might go contrarian and go over this total. It is going to be interesting here, right? If we get to a point where Sunday Night Football rolls around and we're now out to 4, and you get Trey Pipkins upgrade and you get Corey Linsley upgrade, and there might be a sign that Mike Williams can contribute some, although I'm a little bit skeptical upon that, but they did rave that he returned to practice on a Wednesday. I think there could be some sentiment for the Chargers at that number if those key cogs end up being available.
Oh, I can tell you one thing. When you look at the Chargers, it's rinse and repeat every week, at least over the last couple. They get money against them, and it's a question of how many plays Justin Herbert can make to keep them in a game and relevant. I mean, you look at some of the results in recent weeks for the Chargers. Last week against the Raiders, you saw them open as a short road favorite, close a short road underdog, end up losing that game 27-20. Against Arizona, short road favorites, number ends up closing below the key of 3 once Arizona gets some key up upgrades on their offense. Game falls 25-24 against Kansas City, similar song and a dance, and against the 49ers. But pretty wild to think, for the third time in a span of 5 weeks, a Chargers team sitting right around 500 will be playing on the big stage that is Sunday Night Football. So it should be interesting to watch, especially with some of the quarterback that are on display, knowing the level of attachment they have to one another in that draft class. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there as well. Most importantly, as always, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. It's always fun. You break down all the games. You try and uncover all of the angles. But Payne, we know an NFL podcast isn't complete without us identifying the one truly most actionable element. We call it a best bet around here, best investment, however you want to describe it. Where are our trials and tribulations taking us this week in the NFL?
The trials and tribulations, that's an interesting way to pitch that. I think that's the ultimate question, because there's some things that we bet earlier in the week, kind of hinted at liking a couple sides, but they've moved a little bit too far, I think, to feel comfortable giving them out. We were close on the Ravens, but the three has been gobbled up, a game that we broke down that you can hear our full thoughts on above because it'll be time-stamped. But maybe we take a variant of the Ravens and look to a game that does have a low total that continues to get hit under. And we arrive at the Pittsburgh Steelers team total under 19.5 points here. I know it's not the largest market. You can certainly get larger limits on a side or total, but I think this is ultimately the best way to attack this now that the three has gone from the market, and even we're starting to see this trend down towards two, and you really want three in a game like this if you're backing Baltimore. So let's go with the Pittsburgh Steelers under 19.5, and you just think about the last 2 weeks playing in the comfy confines of domes, right? Back-to-back weeks against teams that they could establish their ground game against, and the one thing that we outlined in the preview is you're stepping up in class here, going up against a Baltimore run defense that's sixth in schedule adjusted rush efficiency and been trending substantially better over the last half of the season, number one in defensive rush EPA allowed. So Pittsburgh Steelers team total under 19.5. I think they'll force Kenny Pickett to be a little bit larger role in a game like this, and I'm not quite sure he's up for it. And I think you're going to get the Baltimore Ravens trying to run the ball. The clock's going to be ticking here. So that's the way we're going to navigate this week and go with a team total on the Steelers under 19.5.
And I think when you look at Kenny Pickett's numbers, obviously over the last couple of weeks, we talked at great lengths about how he hasn't turned over the football. The passing numbers don't blow you away. Four out of the last five games, he's under 200 yards passing because he hasn't been asked to do a whole heck of a lot. They played with a lead against the Colts. They played with a lead against the Falcons the last 2 weeks. We'll see if the Ravens defense, knowing that they have to carry the lunch, the water pail for an offense that might be a little bit limited, is able to get out there. And you know what? Worst case, Payne, if it falls 13-10 Steelers, we didn't take the three, which would have led to a push. We're still able to get to the window with the team total under. So every now and again, you have to try and reverse engineer ways to attack the NFL betting market, one of the most efficient that's out there. And when, you know, numbers are moving early in the week, like Payne kind of alluded to, it makes things a little bit more difficult. Any other final?
I think the other interesting element here, Todd, to this board specific, right? Week 14. Just a lot of battles going on out there. Vikings, Lions, going to be a battle. Even as we were recording this, Browns, Bengals, going to be a battle. Buccaneers, 49ers, going to be a battle. I think we'll see some difference of opinion if the Chargers get some guys healthy at kick. So we're seeing a lot of battles in the market right now, and it just kind of indicates what we've been saying, a little bit of a wonky season in the professional side.
I just want to make sure you have ample opportunity to get your Desmond Ridder Offensive Rookie of the Year tickets in. I mean, to see if he can win the award, Payne, playing weeks 15, 16, 17, and 18. You know he's going to put a team over the fantasy hurdle to try and get there. So go claim Drake London off those waiver wires. He'll be the guy that makes all the difference. But for Payne Insider, you can follow him on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Most importantly, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. Best of luck with all of your NFL Week 14 investments. And in a tight-fought, low-scoring football game at Acrisure Field this weekend in Pittsburgh with a Steelers team total under the total. Hopefully we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.